Beauty is a perception. If beauty is a perception, as I will argue in this oratory, then Larry Woods is correct. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Beauty is a perception. What I'm going to do is give a talk which is broken into six parts, and I'm going to tell you the structure so that you can anticipate it and hopefully hold the speech within that structure and walk out of here with that. The six parts of my speech are, first, I'm going to talk about sense organs, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, skin. The second part is I'm going to talk about the problem of objectivity, which is implicit in Larry's comment that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Next, I'm going to talk about a non-human thing, which was raised by one of our members in a conversation that I had, the serial killer. The fourth thing is, I'm going to return back to the realm of the human. I'm going to talk about the problem of snobism when you talk about beauty. The fifth thing is, I'm going to give what I perceive to be the answer to all of the problems which are raised by my thesis. And the answer that I'm going to describe to you is training. And finally, I'm going to talk about the sense, the organ of sense perception, which pertains to human action, good moral human action, and I'm going to claim that the human mind is the organ by which we perceive the beautiful in human action. So, let's undertake an examination of these six areas in my talk. The first was the sense organs. If beauty is a perception, then that which is perceived is dependent upon the organ of perception. Eyes for sight, ears for sound, nose for smell, tongue for taste, skin for touch. If beauty is a perception, then what is perceived is dependent upon the operator of the organ. So the organ is important itself, and also the person who has that organ and who's using it. A man without eyes cannot perceive a beautiful sunset. A woman without hearing cannot perceive a beautiful piece of music. A boy without smell cannot perceive the beautiful fragrance of lavender. An elder whose taste buds are extinct cannot perceive the delightful flavor of an heirloom tomato. And a girl without the sense of touch cannot experience the exquisite feel of walking in the grass with bare feet. So what this means is, what was the point of talking about sense organ is that we need to focus on the idea that the perception of beauty is organ dependent, is operator dependent, and that is of importance. And I think it's of importance because of the second category among my six, which is the problem of objectivity. Now, where this comes in is that Aristotle claims in his Nicomachean Ethics, which we studied in four Sunday schools a year ago at least, Aristotle claims that the object of all ethical action is the beautiful. Now, I'm going a little bit further in saying that I'm claiming that beauty is a perception. A thing that is beautiful just hits you. It strikes you, we say. That strikes me as a beautiful sunset. That strikes me as a beautiful piece of music. But if beauty is a perception, then what objectivity? What happens to objectivity? People like to have or want to have objectivity in morality and in the judgment of beauty generally, I think. Those who chafe at Aristotle's claim that beauty is the object of all ethical action, those people who chafe at that are concerned about this one thing. If beauty is in the eye of the beholder, how can a moralist demand compliance, the compliance of a miscreant, bad guy, who claims to have a different perception of the beautiful or to have none at all? How can he do that? Well, my short answer is that we cannot, because beauty is a perception. If a person looks upon Peter Bruegel's Hunters in the Snow and sees not beauty, He cannot be persuaded. If a person hears "O mio bambino caro" by Puccini and is not moved, he cannot be persuaded. If a person tastes a Chateau Mouton Rothschild and is not pleased or delighted, he cannot be persuaded that he should have been. If a person smells lavender and is not pleased, he cannot be persuaded. And if a person caresses the hair of a beloved and is not enamored, he cannot be persuaded. Beauty is perceived or it is not perceived. I became aware of this idea recently when I was talking with a friend, and the friend did some action, and I said to the friend, "Oh, that was an ugly thing to do." And I think this is a phrase that we all use. You can say, "Oh, that was a beautiful thing he did," or we might say, in my case, was, "That was an ugly thing that you just did." And my friend protested vehemently, "What do you mean it's an ugly thing to have done? Prove it to me. Prove it to me that that was an ugly thing to do." And I suddenly realized that I had an experience. That is, it struck me, it seemed to me, it was obvious to me that what I had seen was an ugly thing. That is, ugly being the opposite of beautiful. It was a perception, and it was mostly indefensible. Or even if I tried to defend it, it's just like trying to prove that that Chateau Mouton Rothschild was a beautiful wine. It was an impossible thing. So that's sort of the origin of my talk, is that awareness, that sudden awareness, when I was talking to a friend about an ugly thing he did, that was an ugly thing, and him asking me to justify it, that it cannot be justified completely. For the moralist, it is a problem that the miscreant cannot be persuaded. Which brings me to the next section of my talk about the serial killer. Now, Ron Menick and I had the great pleasure of going to the Thinking Man's Tavern to talk with Eric Allen and a friend of his, I think. And I don't remember why we went, but what we did there was we had a wonderful conversation about ethics. And Eric and his friend, I think, maybe have been on the same page, but they presented what they thought, and perhaps is, the worst case scenario in ethics, and that is, how does a moralist deal with a serial killer? Eric asks, if I understood him correctly, what good is a morality if it cannot control a serial killer? Now, the religious person might answer this question by asserting that the sinner, the serial killer, will be punished in hell for all eternity for his wicked actions. On the other hand, the dead victims will be made whole in heaven by God. Now, of course, this religious person's answer does nothing to help us or anybody who doesn't happen to be a religious person who doesn't believe in heaven or in hell or in God. Now, an objectivist being faced with this question might answer this question by asserting that the sinner, that is the serial killer, is not leading a flourishing life and is not optimizing his opportunities for happiness. The objectivist might say that the serial killer is not being rationally selfish or exercising rational self-interest. I think I can hear myself as an objectivist having said that, or other objectivists saying it. But how does the objectivist respond to the psychological factual claim that the serial killer enjoys what he does and that he is maximizing his personal options for a flourishing life? The objectivist might deny those facts, but there is some evidence in favor of the factual assertion, and fictional accounts often suggest that serial killers do like their work. Now, my answer to the question is different than those two, the religious and the objectivist. How does a moralist deal with serial killers? And my answer is, you don't. A serial killer is a monster, a monster being something that's not human, or something very much different from a human. Remember Landshark? Who remembers Landshark?
Landshark.
Landshark. This was an old Saturday Night Live skit, and it was first done on November the 8th, 1975. And in this skit, Chevy Chase, who probably everybody knows, is dressed up as a shark. He's knocking on somebody's door, and the unsuspecting victim asks, "Who is it?" And Chevy Chase says, "Land shark." And so the victim opens the door for the stranger, and the land shark bites his head off. The skit was created about 5 months after the release of Jaws. You know, and obviously it's some kind of commentary on the stupidity of people who open their door for strangers, or for people who get in the water with sharks on Long Island or wherever it was they were in the film Jaws. Simply put, there are human monsters in the world. There are land sharks. There really are real land sharks. We avoid them. We jail them. We kill them, or we are victims of them. Nobody in his right mind would climb into a tiger's cage, and nobody in his right mind would jump into the shark tank at SeaWorld. Land sharks, I argue, are outside the domain of human morality, just like real sharks and real tigers are outside the range of human morality. Okay, on to the next part of my talk, which is the problem of snobism. Very big problem, I think, bigger than the one I just talked about, because this is more human. This is human. Now, in my list, when I listed the things which were examples of the beautiful, I listed Hunters in the Snow, O Mia Bambina Caro, Chateau Mouton Rothschild Wine, Lavender, and Bare Feet in the Grass. Remember Larry Wood's dictum, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Yes, it is. I am the beholder, and that was my list. And I am guessing that not everyone, and perhaps not even anyone in the world, would agree with the things that are on my list. And that's not a problem. There are still, everybody else's estimates are as valid as mine. That which is perceived as beautiful is a matter of many factors, and among them are these. The organic equipment, for example, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and skin, that's a factor. The culture in which you were born, West or Eastern or whatever. The society in which you currently live, New York City or Jonesboro, Georgia. Your parents, your economic condition, your education, your training, your native interests, your talents. There are many beautiful things and circumstances that I cannot begin to comprehend. Everyone's list of beautiful things will be different. People who have similar lists will be inclined to associate with one another. People who enjoy NASCAR will hang together. People who enjoy opera will hang together. There is no reason for mature people with a worldly perspective not to have mutual respect for the different ideas of their fellows. I do not happen to enjoy NASCAR, and I do not hang with NASCAR guys and gals. But I have no doubt that some NASCAR things are beautiful, and I am simply not trained to appreciate them. So let us avoid the problem of snobism. To say that I find beautiful opera beautiful is not to say that country music is ugly. There is beautiful opera and there is beautiful country music. To recognize and enjoy the beautiful along with other connoisseurs in one's own favorite domains is not the same thing as denying the existence of other types of connoisseurs and other domains of beauty. So let's avoid this obvious problem of snobism. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and it is not a bad thing. So now I want to talk about what I perceive to be the answer to the puzzle, if you perceive a puzzle here. And the answer is, in a word, training. Now, to begin this topic, I want to talk about my own experience in the French language, and my Sunday school people will have heard at least part of this story already. I studied French in high school. I took French in college. When Atlanta was selected for the Olympic Games on September the 18th, 1990, to become the host city for the 1996 Olympic Games, I started studying French again at L'Alliance Française d'Atlanta on the theory that I wanted to be a volunteer for the 1996 Summer Olympics, because French is the official language of the Olympics. Now, as it turned out, I was a volunteer at the Olympics, and it was one of the high points of my life, like Carnegie Hall was this week, another very high point for me. But I did not speak a word of French. 2 years ago, I started teaching high school French as a volunteer at Alexander's Counterpane Montessori School. And my five seniors graduated Friday a week ago, and that was great. I might teach again next year high school French, although that was initially foreclosed because they had committed to Spanish, but apparently there's a demand for French, at least a small one, that I may be entitled to or allowed to fill. So it's up in the air about whether I'll continue in French, but I hope that I can. During last year in French, we read out loud and translated a novel, which is a French novel. It was given to me by four-member Tom Welch, who's also an advocate or enthusiast for the French language. L'homme qui voulait être heureux, which is the man who wanted to be happy. Now, this is a great story for high school seniors, and it's a great story for Fellowship of Reason. You know, we are all always asking, how is it that we want, how do we get happiness? And the secret to life is in this book, so learn French and learn the secret to life. But what happened this year was that after all these years, I finally glimpsed the forest for the trees. Now, in this metaphor, the trees are the conjugation of verbs in French, the declination of nouns and pronouns in French, the rules of French grammar, the meaning of French words, and the building of French vocabulary. And the forest is the French language as a whole. Now, this was a surprise. I didn't expect to, you know, see something different. But finally I said, you know, those things, that all those little details that I've been learning about, they have a, there's a big picture there. There's a forest to be seen. And I caught a glimpse of this. Now, what the point of that story is this. It means that in order to become proficient in a field, one must have years of experience. Now, I do not claim to be proficient in French merely because I caught a glimpse of the forest, which is the French language. It may take me many more years to become proficient, and I may never achieve that. But my point is simply to illustrate it, how difficult it is to become an expert on any subject. And the subject we are talking about today is beauty and morality. This is a really important subject, and it, I think, will answer ultimately the question of objectivity. Aristotle, in his Ethics that we studied here, makes clear that a moral person is created by training. Now, I'm took the analogy here as to my French experience for 45 years. That's all training. A young person lives among more people and learns by their example. A young person is taught moral behavior. A young person habituates that behavior. And what that means is that the young person opens the door for a lady again and again until it becomes a second nature for him. The young person does not chew with his mouth open because his mother calls on it every time. The young person does not spit on the sidewalk. The rules to which one is habituated in youth is very long. The Georgia Boy Choir, for example, has a literal list in a notebook of the 72 rules of living. Now, they've gone further than most do that, right? As parents, we probably never have enumerated the list of behaviors that we have taught our children or that we want to teach our children. We simply learn them by example as ourselves as young people, and we communicate them to our children by example and sometimes with intention. So that training is the crucial key, I think, for both beauty and morality. And I'm backed up with that by Aristotle. So the sixth part of my talk, the final part, is my argument about the human mind. Let me make the final connection. Beauty is a perception. The beauty of human behavior is also a perception. You see it or not. You are struck by it or not. The organ of perception of the beauty of human behavior is the human mind, supported by the five sense organs and by the mental faculties of the human being, memory, imagination, intelligence, and by a lifetime experience of habituation, teaching, and experience. Plutarch's Lives, which we are studying in Sunday school, is a perfect example of the kind of learning that aids us in studying and studying human behavior. We read Plutarch's biographies about 46 great human beings. We note the kinds of actions that Plutarch chooses to relate. We read his evaluations of them, and we learn what is moral behavior and what is beautiful moral behavior. I do not want you to leave here with the idea that no analysis can be made of the perception of the beautiful. One can perceive that Michael Jackson's dancing in the music video Thriller is beautiful, even sublime. But one can also reason about it. One can say that Michael Jackson's movements in dancing Thriller seem effortless. One can say that his movements are fluid and symmetrical and beat and are imperfect with the music beat. One can say that the choreography is complex but structured. A teacher of dance could say much more about Michael Jackson's Thriller. But after one heard the critic say this stuff about Michael Jackson's Thriller, the hearer would not have perceived that the dance was beautiful unless he perceived it in the first instance. In the same, you cannot be persuaded that Michael Jackson's Thriller dance is the beautiful. You can only perceive it, even if I explained it to you. Beauty is a perception. One either sees it, smells it, tastes it, feels it, or one does not. Conclusion. I have said that beauty is a perception. This proves Larry's theorem that beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. Larry is right. I talked about sense organs to show that beauty is dependent upon the organ, its health, its existence, and dependent upon the operator of the organ. Two, I talked about the problem of objectivity because to show why tying beauty and morality together is perceived to be a problem, because is morality in the eye of the beholder, which is the question that follows. I talked about the serial killer to suggest that they are outside the domain of the human, like land sharks. They are not a subject for morality. I talked, the fourth thing, about the problem of snobism, that we shouldn't fall trapped to that, that when somebody claims that the thing they're looking at is beautiful, and we don't agree with that, that's not, you know, a problem, because people do have different perceptions of the beautiful. People are connoisseurs in different domains of beauty and have interests that are different from one another, and that's not a problem. The fifth thing I said, which is the crucial key, is that the idea of training, to emphasize that the moral training of the young and therefore their habituation to moral behavior is the key to becoming a moral human being. The final thing I said was that the mind is the organ of the perception of the beautiful behavior in conjunction with all of the organs of sight, sound that we have, and with our mental faculties of memory, imagination, and intelligence. So, go therefore in search of the beautiful, surround yourself with it, and in all your actions act to achieve the beautiful. Ask yourself in each situation in life, what is the beautiful thing to do? And do it.